Well, this is Cooper with the HHC podcast, and I'm really pleased and honored to be joined by 17-time LPGA Tour winner, two-time major winner, and current CBS broadcaster. And some call her the Meryl Streep of golf, that some, including myself, the legendary Dottie Pepper. Dottie, thanks so much for coming on.
Well, that was a one-of-a-kind intro. I hadn't heard that one before.
Hey, you gotta remember us somehow, you know?
Not to be forgotten.
Well, yeah, Dottie, we just talked a little bit, and, you know, obviously our podcast focuses on, you know, your background and your golf story. I think, you know, before we get into that, we're obviously, like, right on the heels of the Masters tournament, and I, you know, your blog, I think, said it best. It's hard not to, you know, think about the Masters even the week after. But I'd love to hear your biggest takeaways from this year's Masters tournament.
Well, number one, I'm really glad that somebody read my blog. You know, you never know when you first sort of launch one.
Yeah.
But it was kind of a bleary-eyed Monday after the Masters. Yeah. Post, and I think that's what I've come to expect, and it's never a surprise when you're just a big old flat tire on Monday afternoon and Tuesday after a major championship, especially the Masters. But my main take was how difficult the golf course played over especially the first day.
Yeah.
Second day, the weather changed a little bit with more humidity, and the golf course slowed down a little bit just because of Mother Nature. Day three, I think Mother Nature was the story again, and it was the perfect disruption for Hideki Matsuyama, who had, you know, kind of started to wobble a little bit there, had a pretty darn good round going, but had hit a very poor shot at 11, and then all of a sudden there's an hour and 15 minutes to regroup.
Yeah.
And for some players that helped, and some players that really hurt. For him, I think it won the golf tournament for him. And Sunday, well, he did exactly what he needed to do over the first 9, 10, 11 holes to be able to start making a couple of mistakes and have it be I might not have been super comfortable at the very end. But
yeah.
But for Japan to finally have a major champion, a men's major champion, they've had two women.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, you know, the Masters is it's always so, so great. And there's always so many storylines that pop up throughout the week. Yeah. So, yeah, we love, you know, the broadcast and the whole process and everything. And, of course, you know, you being the first on-course reporter in Masters history. Yeah, we love your commentary and, you know, specific on you know, different holes and whatnot. So, yeah, thanks for that context.
Well, let me tell you what was also, you know, what I take from it was the stark difference from November to April.
Yeah.
Not just the condition of what I would, you know, really call Augusta National, a huge park. You know, you saw it in two different, completely different times of the year. But having patrons back out there, having people, having some noise, I think that people were, as they were a year ago, it seemed like they were hesitant to applaud and hesitant to really get into the rounds. You know, they were wearing masks, and by Sunday, that wasn't the case. People had their energy back, and it was exactly the same in November. It was like people had to warm up to watching golf and participating in a special place, a special tournament in that manner. But by the time Sunday rolled around, you know, there wasn't the noise because there was only about 20% of the folks that were out there. But it really, it had vibrancy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to explain for someone who hasn't been there. And I've been a handful of times, but not since, I believe, 2015 was the last year I was there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, for, you know, to be able to hear the roars and the echoes and know where those are coming from and then wait for the big board to change, you know, it's just such a different atmosphere. And you're right. It was nice to kind of hear a little bit more of that toward the end and on the weekend.
It was. And I hope that, you know, it was nice to be able to have to look to where you're going to exit a green.
Yeah.
If you're walking, right, in my situation.
Yeah.
And I think that the players did get some energy from the patrons that were out there watching. It's been hard on a lot of people to go through with no energy coming from crowds. Other players have had no problem whatsoever. Others have thrived in it.
Certainly.
But it makes television better when there's natural noise that is just energy.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, I know many listeners, you know about Present Dottie and, you know about you and your broadcasting career, but take us back a bit. Like, when were you first introduced to the game of golf?
I was introduced by my dad's mom, my paternal grandmother, in the summer of I'm an August baby, so it was the summer that I went from 7 to 8 years old, and she bought me a starter set of Chichi Rodriguez Northwestern clubs.
Yeah.
At a sporting goods store in Saratoga Springs, purchased me a package of 5 lessons from I would say kind of a journeyman professional who used to be in the area for the summers. He, big racetrack guy. So he came up here and taught and then went to the racetrack to watch the horses. So it got me a series of 5 lessons. I started on a short course. And when I could get it around there, okay, she took me to a place called Brookhaven Golf Club, about 20, 25 minutes from downtown Saratoga Springs, public facility. And that was really where I cut my teeth, but I would say I polished my skills, my trade, just a mile from my house. Eventually, we became members of McGregor Links Golf Club in Wilton, New York, Saratoga Springs, New York, which was just one of the greatest courses in this area. It was really inland links and on sand, and made you hit all sorts of shots. And it was a Devereaux Emmett design and just fabulous golf course. So that was my early story. Played a lot of local tournaments. I didn't schlep it all over the country chasing down junior tournaments. I didn't go to an academy or anything like that. I was I rode my bike and chipped and putted before school and that kind of thing, because I just loved the game from the start.
Yeah. I have to ask, do you have any of those old Chichi Rodriguez irons?
Yes, and they're pitted and they're just awful. But I have all of the woods. I don't know what, maybe somebody must have gotten hold of a couple of the irons, but yes, they're downstairs in the original bag.
Yeah, it's incredible that you say that, because I found a Chichi Rodriguez 5-iron junior club at like a local Goodwill, and I bought it because I was like, you know what, if my son can hit this, he can hit anything.
So, oh my God, they look like butter knives then. It was like, who would ever want to play golf?
I know.
I mean, if that's what you had to learn with, oh my gosh.
I mean, seriously, the iron face is maybe a ball and a half.
Oh yeah, maybe, yeah. Maybe.
Well, it sounds like you were hooked pretty early, but what was it about the game that really pulled you in?
I didn't have to have anybody else to do it with. I could go by myself. And I liked being with my grandmother. She was very fit, big, tall German woman. I think she wore a size 11 shoe or something like that. probably 5'10". I think she even wore a men's size glove. She was just a big, big, sturdy woman. Yeah. And she, I mean, she got to be about an 8 handicap at her best too. So she could get it around just fine.
Yeah.
But I liked the fact that I didn't have to be taken to a practice. I didn't have to have somebody even on the other side of the net, like, you know, if I was going to play tennis. I loved the fact that it was solitary. And then it became team oriented, but I liked the fact that I could do it by myself.
Yeah. When did you realize, like, oh, I'm pretty good at this. Like, I think I could, you know, maybe play really well, like, for a long time.
I think I got the competitive bug real bad around 1979 or so. So I'd been playing the game for 6 seasons, 6 summers. And I got this harebrained idea that I wanted to play in the state junior championship. And my father said, there's no way you're going there, because you're going to expect to win and it's going to be a terrible experience.
Yeah.
So they reined me in for a year, and I still play junior tournaments in and around Saratoga. I think the farthest I ever traveled was maybe, I don't know, 45 minutes away.
Yeah.
If it was somewhere for the little tournament, or I played a lot against the ladies and their leagues that are still going on now.
Yeah.
I was a handicap chairman at, I think, age 14.
Wow.
So I learned the game from the, kind of the grassroots and learned how to do it from the, you know, pencil and learning how to tabulate handicaps that way and post them on cards in the golf shop. So,
yeah.
And for the league, but no, my experience was, it was a state championship was kind of the highlight. And then going to play in trying to qualify for the PGA Junior, because the section paid for one boy and one girl to go to the national championship every year. So that was a way, you know, there was not much money when I grew up. And that was a way for me to get national experience, you know, if I could win the local qualifier.
Yeah. Yeah. I know you said, you know, you didn't go all over the country, and, you know, junior golf is just a whole different beast now, but, you know, you won the 81 state AM, and then I believe the 83 New York Junior AM, and then low AM at the US Open in 84, and then ended up going to Furman. How did you end up making that decision?
Well, a part of it was a plan B decision, because my dad played Major League Baseball but did not have a college degree to fall back on when he left the game. And I think it was always a lessons learned kind of philosophy that you're going to college. You might be some hot shot kid around here, but my dad's preaching was always, if you think you're great, how many states are in the union? 50. There's 50 of you out there.
Yeah.
That, I mean, it might be harsh love, but he's right, because he went through that. He was drafted the day he got out of high school, signed to a contract by the Detroit Tigers, and ended up on the cover of Sports Illustrated.
Wow.
But 7 years later, he has nowhere to play, even with baseball's expansion, because of just who was ahead of him in Detroit, a guy by the name of Norm Cash. He was pretty good.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to have a little bit of fortune, but I think you have to be prepared in a positive way for a plan B. So that was why college was always on the intended radar for me. Ended up at Furman for, you know, for a couple of reasons. One, it was in upstate New York. I could play golf pretty much 12 months a year. And if you're going to decide to maybe play professional golf, you probably got to play somewhere in college that'll help you play at least most of the year. Although people who play at Wisconsin and Minnesota or whatever now would probably tell me I'm crazy, but I think it helps. And secondly, I wanted to be able to get a 4-year degree in 4 years, a worthwhile degree that I wasn't going to be registered. I wasn't going to, you know, I wasn't going to need extra time to graduate. So it came down to TCU and Furman. And so I guess I was going to be wearing purple and white no matter what my decision was.
Yep.
But the thing, I go back and, you know, you always look back and go, wow, that was really lucky. I got really lucky when I was 14 years old, 15 years old. I sent, you know, go to the guidance counselor's office, and you plug into the dot matrix printer and this mainframe computer, you know, that's, you know, big as an office today. What do you want to do? What are your interests? Where do you want to go? What I wanted would be in communications, south of the Mason-Dixon line, and golf. They didn't have the filter to differentiate between men's and women's golf, so it just came up golf. And one of the schools that came up was Clemson. And Clemson, until about 4 years ago, didn't even have a women's golf program, but I sent a letter that ended up in the coach's hand there. And he said, you know, that looks like a pretty darn good resume for somebody who's, you know, really not on anybody's radar at all. And he called Willie Miller at Furman, who was then the men's and women's golf coach. And that's how I ended up there.
Wow.
Totally, totally fortunate.
Yeah.
Where the big guy had a better idea about where I needed to be going to school rather than, than you know, Penn State or TCU or Tulsa or anything like that. All schools that showed interest, but I guess I was pretty much destined for Furman from the time I got that letter in the Clemson coach's hand.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, I think your success obviously continued at Furman, had, you know, 5 college victories and was named All-American 3 times. And then at that point, what was your transition to the LPGA like?
Quick.
Yeah.
It was quick. I graduated in the spring of 87, We lost the national championship by a shot on graduation day. Mm. The scar tissue's still there. Can you tell?
Yeah.
And immediately, you know, just try to plot. Okay, I'm now a professional. How am I going to do this? What tournaments can I play in? Had to give up my exemption to get into the Women's Open because I turned professional from the Curtis Cup. So I had to go back to U.S. Open qualifying. I played some what's now the Symetra Tour. I played as many events as I could get into around there. Unfortunately, at that time, the Symetra Tour had a lot of tournaments in the Northeast in the first half of the summer before you had to get into the LPGA qualifying school. So I played a few of those. I didn't play all of them, but I played a few. And then went to the qualifying school on the first regional qualifier. I promptly missed the cut. And that not by just a couple of shots. I mean, it was pretty comfortably off the planet. Yeah. And had one more chance. So I got in my car and I stopped at my good friend Candy Comer's house in Charlottesville, spent a couple of days hitting balls with her, and continued down to Sarasota, where I, despite having a case of the shanks and I unloaded one on the 53rd hole, I managed to win that qualifier.
Wow.
And then go to the national qualifier in Houston about 3 or 4 weeks later with my sister on the bag, and shot 69 the final day, blew by the world, and ended up with an exempt card. But I think I was just dumb enough to not know the difference between an exempt card and a non-exempt card.
Yeah.
You know, being able to really make your own schedule. And you know, there was a little bit of oblivion that was pretty helpful.
Yeah, certainly. And, you know, you were playing really, really good golf for, you know, really the better part of, you know, almost 2.5 decades. At what mm-hmm. point do you think that you were playing your best golf on the tour?
'91 and '92 were pretty good. I went through '91, did not win a golf tournament and finished third on the money list.
Hmm.
A, I played a lot. B, I played a lot of good golf. C, Meg Mellon just happened to play better.
Yeah.
I think '92 was pretty spectacular. You know, you player of the year and win a major championship in most tournaments, you know, to the very end. But 96 was quietly a very good year. Kind of dug myself out of a pretty nasty hole the beginning of the season and ended up winning 4 times.
Hmm.
Completely unknown to most people because someone by the name of Tiger Woods said hello world right in the middle of that. So to me, that was one of my prouder seasons because I had been in a genuine slump for the first part of the season. It was pretty rugged, and withdrew from 2 tournaments, went back home. I was living in South Carolina at the time, and did 2 days, hit balls till my hands bled, walked a hilly golf course with my, and just played and played and practiced and literally found it in the dirt, and went out and won 4 times in the next 7 weeks. So I was pretty proud of that.
Wow. Yeah, Tiger seemed to get in the way of a few people, I think.
Right? I don't know. I think we're all better for it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you called at 92, you know, money winner, player of the year. I think the ESPY award for female golfer mm-hmm. of the year that year as well. Obviously won the ANA in 92. So, yeah, I would say that was a pretty good year for you. What do you think made the difference in 92 compared to other years?
I think I just closed better. I've been in contention and in and around so many good finishes through 91 that I really came in focused and ready to roll in 92. And I did win in 89 and I won in 90, but to go completely winless and play that good a golf through all of 91, it made me ready to go. And I think that was probably the difference. And I think too, I had one really good weapon that year. And that day, I always called the LPGA every Monday for my stats. I mean, there weren't many of them, and there certainly wasn't anything like ShotLink or anything like that, but they did have people keeping stats. And when that year ended, I was in the top 10 in driving distance and in accuracy. So that was a big weapon.
Yeah.
I mean, to be able to play that kind of offense almost every hole, that was pretty big.
Yeah, totally. So when you look back at your playing career in particular, what would you say is the win that you're most proud of?
1995, the McCall's tournament in Vermont. So it's just an hour and a half. We were at Stratton Mountain Place. I skied growing up. And to me, that was like my fifth major every year because it was my home tournament. There wasn't anything on the Albany, New York area, but we had Stratton Mountain. And it came down to that year, it was between the Bradleys from Boston and the Pepper Clan from Saratoga Springs. And it came down to the two of us. It was a rainy, cold weekend. It was a typical two kids, you know, that grew up in the Northeast where the weather was lousy, battling it out. And I think I ended up winning by three. It was the only tournament my family ever saw me win live.
Wow.
My grandmother that introduced me to the game was alive when I won my first tournament. She spent her winters in Florida, but she had since passed. But my whole clan from Saratoga Springs was there. And I can still, if you roll back that tape, I can still hear my dad yelling in the background. And on top of that, the PGA professional that was there at Stratton Mountain was the assistant at my club where I grew up. I mean, they took me all over the place playing golf and you know, still very, very close friends. They still live in Manchester. But that was a special week. I turned 30 right thereafter. I mean, they had towels on the hillside when I finished on Sunday laid out in the number 30. There were like 30 pennies in my bed. There were 30 golf balls in the bathroom basin. It was just, they all had a great time. And for me to have won that tournament was pretty great. And the champion's chalice we filled with vodka and cranberry and passed it around the room. I mean, we were up to all hours. It was great.
Fantastic. Yeah. So at that point, you know, learned the game at an early age, you know, found some success early and really enjoyed that you could, you know, take ownership over it. Obviously had an incredible playing career. What did you learn about the game that you hadn't expected?
When I look at it now, I think, and it was funny, I was talking to Trevor Immelman about this on Sunday. We were covering the same group for a while at Hilton Head, that we all made it so damn hard. and sometimes our attitudes weren't very good, but we didn't know any better.
Yeah.
So I think that's what I learned. If I had to go back and do it all over again, I'd give myself wider margins.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be nearly as tough on myself.
Yeah. It's funny you say that because I think even for like, you know, the weekend average golfer, like you probably mm-hmm. you make it hard on yourself, you know, like you're chasing a score a lot of times, you know, you're dreaming about shots that you hit, you know, at some point, and you know, think you can do those even though you don't practice that often. And you see that so much, like on both tours and all tours at this point, you know, where you're exactly right, there doesn't seem to be a lot of grace or like margin for error or fun sometimes, you know, you don't see a lot of guys really like enjoying that moment because it is, you know, at least from an outsider perspective, seems stressful.
It is stressful.
Yeah.
But I think there's ways to manage it. I mean, one of my great management tools was the fact that I almost always traveled with my dog.
Yeah.
And we, if not dogs plural, knew where all the parks were, so I wasn't hanging around the locker room. I wasn't at the golf course all day, all night, and that was. And I would do that all over again in a heartbeat. But I think we make it so darn hard.
Yeah.
That maybe it's not as fun as it could be just because we've made those decisions.
Certainly.
We've made those choices.
Well, skipping ahead a little bit, you know, 2004 announced retirement at the end of the year and then, you know, went mm-hmm. into work for NBC and the Golf Channel in 2005. How did that transition happen and how did you know that broadcasting was the move?
I actually did my first tournament in television in 1999. So I'd won a major championship that year and Judy Rankin had kind of given me a nudge and she was working for ESPN, ABC at the time, and they had the contract for the USGA, and the women's amateur was at Biltmore Forest, not very far from where I live in South Carolina. And she said, you know, I think you ought to come work with us that week. There wasn't an LPGA tournament on the schedule. She said, I think you might be okay at this. And I said, well, why not? I'm off. So she stayed with me. We had about a 45-minute drive every day. I picked her brain about everything you could possibly imagine. And then I kind of got through the week and I had a good time and just kind of left it at that. But a couple years later, we were doing a Wendy's 3-Tour Challenge and they did a sit down and she asked the questions and she said, well, like when you're not playing golf anymore, what do you want to do? And I said, Judy Rankin, I want your job. And that's kind of how it turned out.
Yeah.
And then we are very, very good friends. And I owe her a lot of credit for getting me, you know, to talking me up a little bit to the people that make those decisions. And also, you know, for Tommy Roy, listening to John Goldstein, who used to be Tommy, the head producer at NBC, listening to John Goldstein, who used to be one of the best statisticians in the game, saying, you know, Dottie's not going to play anymore. You might want to give her a shot.
Yeah.
And it happened that week. I got up that morning and I knew I was done playing. I absolutely knew I was done playing. I had withdrawn from the Women's Open. And it was, you know, I guess there's, you know, the kind of sweet and sour of it, but the sweet of it was that I had a front seat at the biggest tournament on the women's schedule, and yep, that was my first event.
Amazing. What's your favorite tournament to be part of from a broadcasting standpoint?
Oof, the last one of the year.
Yeah.
<I don't know. laughs> When it gets to be Sunday of the last event,
yeah,
which is Dragon. I don't know. There are just certain places you love going back to. I mean, every time you get to the Masters, you got to pinch yourself because you're there.
Yeah.
And I guess that's the one. It's also, to me, it's the one that it's the most stressful because there's so many people watching and there's, and it's not your usual golf audience. It's a week that you're so excited that it's there, and then when it's over, it's like, oh, what a relief. And hope you did a good job because yeah, you always want to put your best stuff out there. And my husband will often say, "Dot, not every show is going to win an Emmy, but but you feel like you want to prepare that way, and hopefully that's the highlight of the season."
Certainly, yeah. I think you know you even called it out, you know, on the blog when you talked about, you know, there's just something different about, you know, the Masters and you know, nothing against, you know, the RBC or, you know, any other tournament that follows a major, but you called out the fact that, you know, there's just so much energy that's exerted in those weeks versus others.
Yeah. And I think you find a reserve of energy that maybe you didn't realize you had. And then when you do come down, it's even further.
Yep. Yeah. Well, we talked about it a little bit before we started, but you have obviously just launched a book. I think yesterday was the release day. Tell us about the book and how it came about.
Well, yesterday was the official release date. We've been taking pre-orders for about 6 weeks, I guess, but yesterday was it. And it's entitled Letters to a Future Champion, and it's about my relationship with my teacher, because it was anything but what we now consider normal teacher-student sort of relationship. He was a World War I veteran for starters, one of the founders of the Northeastern New York PGA section, but we didn't start working together until George Pulver was 81 years old.
Wow.
And he did everything there was to do in the game. From golf course architect to agronomist to club maker, you know, cleaning the toilets. That's what everybody on the PGA professionals did it all then. He was an amazing man, but he'd be so embarrassed by all of this, all of the attention. But he was my mentor. He was my best pal. He was one that could call me out when things weren't going well, but he was was amazing on how he, despite his wife would pass away 4 days after he agreed to start working with me. I knew both of them from being around in this area, kind of golf royalty in this area. And what he did after every lesson, and often many, many times beyond that, he left me a letter in my mailbox, a typewritten, mostly typewritten, summation of the lessons, things to look forward to, life lessons, talking about resiliency and what the great players did, what he called them, the super greats, why they were what they were. And he also left books for me to read. When he passed away in 86, part of his golf library was left to me. And I think based on that, and having all of these letters in a three-ring binder, I'd been told that, you know, years ago that this would be a great book. So the plan was just to make, we're going to put these letters in a great format and the letters are going to stand by themselves. And then I had three people who are pretty smart, a lot smarter than me, and involved in golf and involved in golf design and book design. And they said, Dottie, there's more here that you need to turn yourself inside out. I was like, well, that's not comfortable. I don't like that. I don't particularly care about talking about myself. They said, you owe it to him to do that. So I had been in contact through the whole time since he'd been gone with his family. And they were 200% behind it. And it doesn't happen if they're not enthusiastic about it, because I also needed their help looking for more family photos and telling more stories about things about him that I didn't know. So it's been just about a year that it took us to get from that old beat up three ring binder to where we are today. But it was COVID too. I had time to do it. I just decided when we got shut down so hard in upstate New York that I was going to make something positive of that time instead of just, you know, sitting on the couch and watching the news and getting really bummed out about the whole thing.
Yeah.
So it was a little bit COVID inspired to make a difference, to do something positive, but none of it would have happened without the support of his family.
Certainly. Well, I can't wait to read it. Where can people find it? Where can we go buy it?
You can buy it right off my own website at dottiepepper.net. Or you can also get it in our local bookstore here in Saratoga Springs. They have copies that you can probably get faster because I'm fulfilling all these orders myself.
Yeah.
They're at thenorthshire.com, and it's an independent bookseller. So it's on the indies list as well.
Great. Well, perfect. Well, Dottie, like I said, this has been so much fun. Who knew that we would bond about a Chichi Rodriguez Northwestern butter knife?
It was a butter knife for kids. Good Lord. What were they thinking?
I know. Well, thank you so much for taking a few minutes. I know this is a really busy and exciting week for you, so we couldn't be more excited to have you on.
Oh, thanks, Cooper.
Yeah.